seem extra blasty today. Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, welcome, and slancha. This is Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM. My name is Scotty Hertz. And I have to say, it's rather warm in the bunker today. So if I sound a little bit off, it's because I got a fan blowing, which you may or may not hear in the background. I don't know what happened. My ventilation system's failed, and I'll have to call, some East German person to come fix it. On the line, I hopefully have Dr. Adam A. Donaldson with me. Adam, are you there? I seem to have lost him. I have a little bit of a tech issue with...
No, I'm here. Sorry.
He's here. Me. Okay, good, good. Yeah, I wasn't sure what the heck was going on there, but we found you. How's things, Adam?
I'm not sure about you calling me a doctor, because I think
that's... I don't know what happened there. That just came out. It's like the honorary Reverend Doctor, right? It's I've just given you an honorary doctorate from CFRU University.
All right.
That I just invented now off the top of my head. Speaking of the top of my head, or see the pants? No. In the part two of the show, we will have Adam's interview with Councillor Mark McKinnon. Much looking forward to that. I haven't heard it yet, but I'm sure it's a hot one. And before we get to that, we're going to talk about the Republican National Convention and all the excitement that's going on there. Ooh, boy, I tell you, it's a laugh a minute anyway. But to start off with, we're going to look into or talk a bit about the conservative leadership race, which was won by Erin O'Toole. After a few ballots, it wasn't the barn burner of 12 or 13 ballots of the last leadership race, but technical difficulties seemed to hold things up. I definitely went to bed, Adam. I don't know if you stayed up. I mean, I didn't have that much invested in it. It's like, yeah, I really want to hear, but you know, I can wait till coffee in the morning to see who won this thing.
Oh, no, I was up until it was done.
Die hard.
Not necessarily. I mean, I agree with you. I perhaps not entirely invested in the outcome, but I was working on something else. And yeah, just incidentally, around 1 o'clock, around 12:30, 1 o'clock, they finally were able to get the ballots counted, or at least announce the results of the ballot counting. And yeah, it went. Well, I'm not going to say it went as predicted, because I think a lot of people were expecting Peter McKay to win, but a lot of the commentary, all the commentary before the ballots were counted, about 6 hours of commentary, was suggesting that unless Peter McKay could get over 40% on the first round, it was going to be difficult for him to come out of the air quote convention a winner. And that's more or less what happened. As soon as like the first round was completed and McKay was at like 33% and O'Toole was at 32%, it was more or less a done deal for O'Toole at that point, because Sloan's numbers, and this did end up happening, Sloan's ballots ended up going to Leslyn Lewis, and when she was dropped off at the second round, her ballots almost entirely went to Erin O'Toole, and resulted in him having a fairly decisive victory over Peter McKay.
And that's what's interesting about a ranked ballot system like this. It's always said that you really get the candidate that people want when you're able to kind of split it up a bit. And it sounds like Leslyn Lewis got on the second ballot, but she had the most raw votes, didn't she? I mean, if it was just a straight up, we count every vote as one, then she would have won. But this system is, it's number of votes, but also points, right? So each riding has a certain amount of points associated with it. And, you know, win the riding, then you win that. It's almost like a mini electoral college, right? I mean, I have to be honest, I don't completely understand the system, because I know you can run it a few different ways, but it's done this way in the interest of fairness, but also that, you know, not any one, supposedly it's more equal or more equitable, at least, right?
Right. Interestingly, it's one of the things that came out of the 2003 agreement that created the Conservative Party was to do things this way, to have things weighed not just by the number of delegates, but by region as well, because the concern of, you know, a lot of progressive conservative people at the time was that the West would run roughshod, that it would be Western leader after Western leader after Western leader of the new Conservative Party, and no one from the East would be able to elevate to that position. So they made this deal to have the region's weight. And what's interesting about Leslyn Lewis is it wasn't like a universal, when, because on the first round they went province by province, and she was number two in more than one. I wasn't keeping an exact count, but, you know, it was surprising the number of times she would place second in the race. And I do wonder what all was behind that, if it was just, you know, sort of like she wasn't Peter McKay or Erin O'Toole, and so we'll throw our support behind her, or whether, you know, people actually were interested in some of her platform. But I think, you know, Erin O'Toole would be crazy not to have her in the inner circle going forward, because clearly she spoke to somebody, and spoke to a lot of somebodies, given not just how she ended up finishing, but a lot of the fundraising. Like she made almost $2 million right before the finish line. It's incredible that, you know, she was actually a force to be reckoned with, and it was actually a kingmaker in this race too, which was an interesting how that turned out.
For sure. And from what I'm hearing today, it sounds like she's definitely going to run. She did run in the last election. She was the sub for, and I can't remember the riding, but it was where the candidate was caught on candid camera urinating in the coffee mug, that guy. So she was the last, if I understand right, she was the last minute replacement for him. And would obviously be a better candidate to see her speak, very well spoken, on top of the issues with conservatives. I honestly think, this is just my opinion, that if she didn't have the social conservative views that she did, she probably would have been the leader. Because I think that is, conservatives know deep down, the majority of them anyway, I think even the ones that sort of lean towards social conservatism, that you can't win a Canadian election with deep social conservative values. You just can't. And we saw that with Erin O'Toole. And I did a bit of a double take when I heard him the next day saying, I ran as a pro-choice candidate. And I had to think about it for a second. Like, oh yeah, that's right. He's not a social conservative, to the point where he's outright saying he's pro-choice, also very pro-LGBT views. Yeah, I don't want to give him too much credit. He's okay with the gay. I don't know what you want to say, but yeah, he's one of those. He would go to Pride if the cops were in it in Toronto. So he's that. It's kind of like Doug Ford, I guess, in that realm.
Well, there's also a tape of him talking to supporters in Quebec where he said that he was a bit iffy on the federal government's plan to ban conversion therapy, which, if you know anything about conversion therapy, it's basically torturing kids for being gay, and in the assumption that torture will cure them of gayness, and that is to be on the fence about that is kind of not great.
Yeah, and of course Lewis and Sloan, and a lot of people were hoping that Sloan is just going to go away, and I think the Liberals are trying to go for the jugular with him. It's like, you should get him out of cabinet because of some of the thing, or out of the caucus because of some of the things that he said. And yeah, I mean, he really belongs with the Peoples or something, but I don't know. I guess that's again just my opinion, but he'll hang around until, I don't know, they can probably dispose of him somehow or not. I don't know. But he ran the race, and how's that for now? Say, dispose of him now. No, I'm just, that was probably an inappropriate choice of words. But you know what I mean? He'll get sidelined somehow. They'll just like, could you please forget about this guy and focus on Leslyn Lewis, because she's the conservative, so-con. I guess that's what they say. The social conservative that, an acceptable face, let's say, of that. Now, you mentioned Quebec and O'Toole speaking Quebec. It looks like a lot of the Quebec ridings, and this is when they have this balanced system, were the make or break for McKay. And a lot of it looked like a lot of the ridings that weren't, because they're smaller, but yet their value is the same in terms of riding rather than number of votes. Like, you could have a riding in Toronto that has, I don't know, let's say 5,000 votes, but one in Quebec that only has 50, right? So those gaps, this was according to CBC, who's Eric Grenier. Did a bit of a deep dive on the Quebec riding, saying the gap is what, you know, made or broke McKay in a lot of them. And this is the thing too, it's O'Toole's job now, other than sort of placating the social conservatives, which he definitely needs to do because they put him over the top, is the person that wins pretty much Ontario and Quebec that will win the next election, which may come at us sooner rather than later. It sounds like it's in the election grumblings are already on. It's been said that the $2 billion that was thrown at the schools this week from Trudeau the Trudeau government is sort of like, is this electioneering? We're not sure how to interpret this. So the odds, they're obviously in on a war footing, ready to go. And they will need to ramp it up and get their candidates in line and everything in order, because the odds are fairly good that there may be an election sooner rather than later?
It depends.
Yeah, I think, that's true. Yeah.
I mean, things seem a bit hot right now because, proroguing happened a week ago. And, the $2 billion in almost literally last minute money for schools, has the picture of the feeling of an election written all over it. I know that Elections Canada, too, and there was a report on this today, is working on how to have elections in the COVID era. A lot of the changes they're talking about, including moving Election Day from Monday to having like 2 days of voting on the weekend, so Saturday and Sunday, which would be a huge move.
Yeah. Sunday elections, like Russian style, right? You'll vote on Sunday, yeah.
Yeah, maybe we don't want to compare ourselves to Russian elections.
No, but at least the day is the same, or it might be the same, right?
But
remember, you couldn't vote on the Sabbath. Now it's like, yeah, you probably, if you can shop, you can vote, right? So,
right. But at the same time, though, that stuff would have to be fixed in legislation, which is something we talked about last week in the case of New Brunswick. And, if the Liberals were to introduce those recommendations from Elections Canada, say, okay, let's change the election laws, what would happen politically? There would probably be a lot of outrage, even if the Liberals were to say, look, we're just planning for, a rainy day or whatever. That's going to be tricky. And then the Liberals may be of a mind that, we can go to the polls. The Conservatives are maybe of a mind like, let's go to the polls. One of them still needs the support of the Bloc, the NDP, and, for good measure, the Greens. The NDP are certainly not in a position to go to an election right now. The Greens talk a lot about, working in the system, and they have to, they still are leaderless, technically, and will be leaderless until October. So there's that consideration afoot. And I think with those two parties together with the Liberals, you get enough to hang on, even if the Bloc, for some paradoxical reason, wants to dissolve Parliament. I don't understand Francois Blanchet's play there, but I think it's at least feasible that we will at least get through the speech from the throne, but what do I know?
He's acting as a bit of an agitator, right? It's like, you better get this together or else, right? So
so
we'll see. I guess it was, I'm not sure what I was gonna say there. I think I'm overheating, Adam. I really am, but it'll be
this pretty humid today.
It will be an interesting one to watch and to see O'Toole in action. He's probably going to take the next few weeks to do the rounds, and I don't know if virtually or physically going to go places. I did notice that their physical distancing was pretty terrible at the, all shaking hands at the end.
It's party. Like
you might be conservatives, but that's not a bubble, people. So,
and one thing that may hang on O'Toole is the involvement of the Ontario Proud and Canada Proud folks, which we didn't get a chance to really get into. But the one guy, Rick, what is his name? Rick something.
Yeah, the one waving the bottle of Clicquot around
Was the one chugging the Cristal, Jeff Ballingall. And he tweeted the next day a picture of the office door to the official opposition leader's office saying, "We got a lot of work to do," which seems to imply that, you know, O'Toole didn't just win with the help and support of Ontario Proud, but they are kind of actively involved in forming whatever campaign apparatus he's working on. And I would point out that, it was, that team helped Doug Ford achieve victory in Ontario. But I would also argue, on the other hand, and I can't take 100% credit for this original thought, but we know the limitation of governing by memes, especially in the COVID era. So
you have to wonder, the guy's gonna be like, "You owe me, man, you owe me," but maybe not. We shall see, right? So speaking of terrible social distancing, the Republican National Convention is also in full swing this week, and it's pretty ridiculous. I saw that Donald and Melania just sort of making their way down into this crowd. It was like, you wouldn't think anything was wrong. And they haven't really mentioned COVID too much, where I can tell. I think I heard Mike Pence say it in passing, the coronavirus, but they're really trying to keep that quiet. I think they're trying to keep a lot of things on the QT, but also trying to pump up their version of reality. Like, you know, there's a lot of women that really like Donald Trump, and there's a lot of black people that really like Donald Trump. And it's almost to the point of ridiculousness when we see.
I wrote a quote from Larry Kudlow from his speech on Tuesday night. And this is him talking about COVID-19 in the past tense. "It was awful. Health and economic impacts were tragic. Hardship and heartbreak were everywhere. But presidential leadership has swiftly and effectively, with an extraordinary rescue for health and safety, to successfully fight the COVID virus." So he's talking like it's over. And on that same day, there were nearly 1,200 new people who died from COVID. And in the last week, there were nearly 300,000 new COVID cases just that week. So, you know, when you hear somebody in the administration talk like it's been over for a while, we're definitely in a world where there's a separate reality being constructed, and it's kind of right there on our TVs.
That's right, where the regular rules of time and space do not apply, and that's definitely a lot of that going on. I did see one comment, and it was pretty funny, that when you see that many people with the same last name on a bill somewhere, we're talking like North Korean style rally rather than something you might see in America, because all the Trumps, even Tiffany Trump, like, she's been off the grid for a long time, and Tiffany comes out and says nice things about her dad and all the kids. And what was her name again? The Don Jr.'s girlfriend really letting it happen in the red dress. Guilfoyle or something?
Kimberly Guilfoyle.
Don't know too much about her. What's her connection?
She was married to Gavin Newsom, who is the current governor of California. I think at the time they were married, he was the mayor of San Francisco.
She's effectively the other woman in Don's life, right?
Yeah, she's his...
Don was married and had a bunch of kids. This has turned into G-Talk Nightly, but Don was married and had a bunch of kids, and now he's with the woman in the red dress screaming her head off at the thing.
In the new book, Hoax, which is about the relationship between Fox News and Trump, the Trump campaign and the Trump White House, there's some discussion about Kimberly Guilfoyle and how she ended up with Don Jr., about how she went to Fox News and became a commentator on there because it's good money to be an attractive woman that's pro-Trump on Fox News. And somebody had a quote about her that says something to the effect of she was a blank slate. And being a spokesperson for the Democrats but had better money, she would definitely do that, which doesn't speak well to her character, I'm afraid.
No, because it was full shill from what I can tell, she kicked it off. That picture, which went on our website, among other things, is absolutely fantastic. It's like, what is going on there? It's so, and you could probably say that about a lot of the convention so far. Daniel Day, ex of the Toronto Star, who was famously chased by Rob Ford, took his Trump
That's, I think if he's famous for other things, but yeah.
if that name sounds familiar, he took his Trump liometer or whatever he was calling it to CNN. He called like most of what's going on at the convention the parade of dishonesty. So he's made an entire career of saying, of kind of following what Trump says and others within the sphere and what Republicans say, which is just kind of false, sort of false and blatant out mistruth and lies. And he's like, he was just like number one being Trump saying, I've kept every single promise that I've made. And I think, and Pence said that about him as well, which is definitely not true. That's a big turkey of a lie, actually. But the problem, I think, with this convention, I mean, of course, it's aiming squarely at the base. But if I understand it right, there is no policy coming out of this. It's just kind of all on the fly. It's like, oh, they're riding down in Kenosha. Well, yeah, that's good. Law and order. And you would expect to hear that dun-dun sound. That it's just sheer drama at this point. And you had mentioned it too in our on the website as well, the Hatch Act. It sounds like Trump is doing sort of political things in the middle of this convention, and he's not really supposed to, right?
Right. Yeah. No, the Hatch Act is an American law, and it's like it's almost as old as the Constitution. Somebody had the foresight right there from the beginning to say, hey, here's an idea. Let's not use government property to campaign for political office. And there was seemed to be widespread agreement on that. So the Hatch Act eventually became law. And yeah, it's been violated all over the place because you had Melania Trump's speech on White House grounds. On Tuesday night, you had Vice President Mike Pence speaking at Fort McHenry in Maryland on Wednesday night, which is Fort McHenry is famous for being the place that where the battle in the War of 1812 inspired the Star-Spangled Banner. Mm-hmm. And then tonight, Donald Trump is talking on the south lawn of the White House. There was a rumor. I don't know if it will bear out, but there was a rumor that he would arrive via Marine One, which is the presidential helicopter.
Looks good. Which, looks really good on camera.
Right. Which and I mean, people have been kind of lowballing this. People at the White House are calling him the talent in chief, which is just so grimy. But yeah. I saw an ABC report. It was either yesterday or today, where they would say like Donald Trump's using the full power of the presidency to put on this show, and it's like, No. He is putting on – he is breaking the law to put on a show. And I've been – in watching the coverage, and every time they talk about it, I wish they would freight – every time they talk about, you know, these speeches, these activities, it's illegal. He's using the White House. He's using the Marine guards who are there in the White House to open a door. He's using them. You're not supposed to be using Marines. They're there on duty. He used a naturalization ceremony.
That's right. It sounds like some of the people at that ceremony didn't even know that it was part of the convention, essentially, right?
And more than that, there are people suing the immigration department right now because they are way, way behind in these naturalization ceremonies, and people want to be able to get registered to vote for the fall, and they're running out of time. So there's a huge backlog, and here's Donald Trump using this as political theater. And then before that, he gives this one man a pardon on live television, which is another breach of presidential authority. And that all led up to the big one, which was that Mike Pompeo, on an official trip as a Secretary of State in the United States, stopped in Jerusalem and went up to the top of the King David Hotel and recorded his speech, which is a huge violation of not just the Hatch Act, but of Mike Pompeo's own memos to his own department about State Department employees not getting involved in political affairs. He issued a memo earlier this year, like in February, saying like, hey, don't get involved in political stuff. And here he was, literally using his job to make a political speech.
And I guess the question is, how will they be punished for it, or who's going to come after them? Or is it just going to be another, they're probably just going to let it go. And also this week, too, there was lots of crashing and burning, and some sections of Republicanism, not just out of the convention, but of course we talked a bit about Bannon. I would probably include Jerry Falwell Jr. in that, who is a massive Trump supporter and his own scandal going on. But of course, somebody who's integrated it in the family, Kellyanne Conway, who spoke, and I didn't actually see it. I did see a bit of her coming out to talk, which is her swan song, I guess, because she's leaving the fold due to, it sounds like, a more time with the family situation. And from her daughter's tweets and Instagram, it probably is a family situation. But I'm not sure how much she had. Did you catch any of that? What she was saying, or does it really even matter? What she was saying, she's just kind of Trump's great. See you later. My daughter's out of control.
Yeah, I saw her convention speech. I did not see her speech on Monday, but I mean, it's kind of a sad situation in a sense. I mean, I don't feel sad for her. I feel sad for the daughter who is clearly acting out because, I mean, we don't know what's happening in the Conway home, but there has to definitely be something happening in the Conway home because their daughter is acting out on TikTok and on social media. George Conway being heavily involved in the very anti-Trump Lincoln Project group, Kellyanne Conway being sort of the last person standing from the 2016 yeah, campaign.
It has to be a really weird house to live in. It really does.
Yeah. And you know, I think enough was enough. I don't know I don't think anyone really in the public eye anyway really understands what happened in their home, but it does sound like
the laundry's out. It's unfortunate, I suppose. As I don't know. She's an interesting character.
Yeah. Yeah, she was talking online about emancipating herself and
the daughter. Yeah, that's right. She's like had enough of the parents.
You know,
yeah.
So it may be the one instance of spending more time with the family ends up being a legit excuse and immediately understandable because I mean it's all right there unfortunately before our eyes that yeah.
Something else that's been going on is the convention has been getting lower ratings than the Democrats, which is probably driving Trump completely bonkers. I haven't seen any tweets on it yet, but he's always really big with the highest ratings. So it sounds like the raw numbers are in for the and the Democrats have taken it so far. I guess it depends on what they've got lined up for the next. This goes till Saturday or something. We're kind of in the middle of it, right? Is that
no? Nope, this is the last night tonight.
Oh, this is the last night. Okay, so I'm a little bit behind. So what's planned for? It'll be fireworks and flags. Lots of flags. Like the flags. Oh man, they own the flag. Right.
Yeah, I think Mitch McConnell's on tonight.
Oh boy! Oh boy, Mitch McConnell.
Ivanka Trump is going to be the lead-in speaker to Donald Trump. So
my dad would date me if I wasn't his daughter. Yeah, no, she won't say that. Probably.
That would be an interesting way to open the speech, but I have a feeling it's going to be a. It's going to be a repeat. I mean, he was caught on camera today talking about how the NBA is a political organization now because so many of them are upset that another unarmed black guy was shot 7 times in the back on cell phone video. And we just found out today, this happened on Sunday, and we just found out today the name of the officer who did it. No sign of him being arrested yet. And that was another thing is that the attorney general for Kentucky was – did a convention speech last night, and a lot of people are on him because the police officers that killed Breonna Taylor have not yet been charged either. So it's some of the stuff they've done because the attorney general for Kentucky is a black man, but some of it has in terms of presenting that this is one big happy family and the Republican Party is definitely kind of backlash too.
Well, we'll see how this goes, and no doubt we'll be giving more or having more let's call it American election coverage because I we should probably do a show, eh, Adam? Like one on the day. we've become quite entangled in the whole thing, even though it's we're observing from afar. But it was fun to do the 2016. I can't believe we've been at this that long. It's been that long, but speaking of long, we've talked for a long time, so we're going to take a little bit of a break, and we will be back after a few short messages and a little bit of music. So please stick around for part 2.
Do it.
There's something brand new from a band called High School Project out of Toronto. And that was called, as you can imagine, these days, Addicted to the Radio. As we are, like completely. Absolutely, that's why we do this, because we're addicted to the radio. So, now, Adam, you spoke to Councillor Mark McKinnon this week.
Yes, we spoke yesterday.
That's okay. Do you want to set this? You want to set this up? Are you?
Yeah. No. I was. I mean, there's been a lot going on at City Hall lately, and you know, just unusual because we have August. We've had August council meetings, which is unusual. For as long as I can remember, there's never been August council meetings. But I'll just say, you know, we touched on the COVID response. We touched on the new library debate that has arisen, and what life in Ward 6 will be like without the U of G students coming back. So that's something we talked about up front. So let's press play.
Excellent. Let's get to that now.
Coming on with us today.
Well, as always, I appreciate you having me, Adam.
Well, let's begin. Let's begin very sort of like central to your ward, Ward 6. This would be a kind of an exciting time in your neck of the woods, because you would have the U of G students who are, you know, making their way back to town, who are setting themselves up in off-campus housing, which is a lot of it in and around Ward 6. This is going to be a very different fall for people in your area this year, isn't it, without the students around?
Yeah, quite. Given, obviously, that so few students are enrolled for in-person class at the university, although I do have to wonder, of course, and I don't have stats for it, but a lot of people sign up for year-long leases, and even though the pandemic has hit and people didn't know what's happening, I'm sure that there are lots of people that are students that are still under leases come the fall. Maybe they're starting in September, or maybe they started in May and it's extending for the year. So I'm actually wondering how many people are going to be moving and maybe doing remote classes, but still doing it in Guelph rather than staying at home with the folks or whatnot. So we still might have a lot of students in the area, but those numbers, I don't have what they are right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were joking a bit before we started recording. You are one of the quiet ones in council, even the virtual council meetings we've been having. So just your impressions of like the city's response to the pandemic, whether that is with the like incentives like the dining district, whether that's the fiscal prudent measures that have been taken, you know, how do you think the city has weathered the pandemic so far?
It's been hard, of course, on staff, as you know, politicians, you know, we do our job, but in the end, all the heavy lifting is being done by staff. And, you know, the number of layoffs that we had was hard on us, but senior staff reacted really quickly, but not in a rushed way, like quickly as in a quick, thoughtful, like getting people together, making different committees and groups to discuss different aspects, whether it's economic revitalization or talking about safety protocols. And we're doing a lot of things remotely now, not just council with our council meetings, but also staff, a lot of staff. I mean, obviously, if you were kind of working outside as a parks and rec, you can't do that from your computer. I mean, it'd be great if we had lawnmowers that you can operate from your computer, but that's not quite there yet. But certainly a lot of the more administration stuff has maybe opened everyone's eyes on what can be done remotely. I saw a meme on the internet talking about how, you know, remember all those jobs that people said you couldn't do remotely? Well, we found out that you can do it remotely. And I think that's something that can really impact the city going forward. It is, how often do we need people to come into an office now versus working from home? And that, and we're not the only ones. It's not just the cities, and corporations are undergoing that as well. But I would say the city staff was really good in what they did. We, with city staffs, but council agreed with staff's opinion, we should not be making political decisions based on the health. We you know, council is not voting on whether we should have masks in buses, or we are not voting whether or not we should have masks mandatory in certain buildings. That is what's coming from public health. And I'm really proud that in Guelph, we've taken the jobs that some other cities are making political decisions. We are not. We're making health-based, evidence-based decisions led by Nicola Mercer of the public health group. So there's some interesting things that we've ended up doing by, you know, we obviously cut back on a bunch of stuff, whether it's recreation or park maintenance, for example. But on other things, we pivoted in different directions, like the dining district. And while I was one of the few people that didn't support it in the exact form that it turned out to be, I think that the concept of an outdoor space and allowing businesses to have a little bit more flexible about using the space differently and the public space. And I think that was, you know, a really good outcome and people like it. I think some of the outcomes in the end with people not bubbling properly and social distancing, maybe it's not as adhered to as strongly as it should in the dining district. But I think that we were in an emergency situation and we're taking measures that on a maybe a test run, a trial run, whether it's cutting off some lanes of traffic in order to have extra space for pedestrians and cyclists, or doing something downtown with allowing people patios to come out. I think staff has led an excellent program going forward, and I have certainly no complaints about how staff has been moving forward with that. I can't take any credit because it's not, this is not political. This was mainly due to staff doing that. And I'll often have to give a shout out for Mayor Guthrie as well. You know, as although most councillors have kind of our duties and our involvement has been reduced because we're not in City Hall as often, we're not quite as engaged. Mayor Guthrie certainly has still had his hands full and has been engaging with staff very frequently on a lot of different committees. So, you know, he's working with staff directly to make sure we can get through the best we can.
How you phrase that, it interests me in terms of the oversight role and the balance of, you know, having the elected officials there. I think people understand, of course, the safety of not having people in City Hall if possible, and perhaps that rightfully includes councillors. But is there a concern, you know, in reflecting some of the concerns I've seen online and people who've spoken at city council meetings, their delegations, that, you know, maybe there has been too much delegation of authority? And have you been comfortable with that just in a general sense, not necessarily in the specific sense of responding to the pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. It is the right way to go. And part of the issues that come from the reflection of, say, residents of Guelph is they're not understanding the role that council has, that we are not managers. We are not operators. We are an oversight board. And so we want all of our staff who are professionals, who are skilled and trained and paid well, to do the jobs that council is not doing the jobs. What we're going to do as council is we have to oversee the budget, and we have to oversee kind of on a high level strategic direction for the city, but we are not supposed to be getting involved with all these decision making. So when I see some cities where council had to have a meeting whether or not there's going to be masks in certain buildings, and that's a political decision, I'm thinking that, well, why are politicians who might have no background in healthcare, no background in anything to do with making a decision that's evidence-based, why isn't that left to staff? And staff in conjunction working with, of course, public health. And so anyone who thinks that we're delegating too much authority, I believe they don't understand that we're not supposed to be micromanagers. And often counselors will do that. You know, something will come up and we want to get our hands into it and we want to kind of play with it and manipulate it because we're passionate about governance. But it's really easy to stray over that line into a managerial role or perhaps even a bureaucratic role. And we don't want to do that. We want to step back and direct overall staff to make the movements, which is why we have one employee, and that is our CAO, Scott Stewart. He's the only person that we hire and fire if we need to. We have one, and then he is then the manager of the entire city. And I think that's the way it should be done. Now, obviously, when it comes to making financial decisions on, you know, budgeting, where we go, where we put money towards that, that is falls on council role because that is the oversight that we bring. But I'm really happy with the fact that staff has picked up the ball and run with it during the pandemic when we're not interacting as much and we don't have maybe as many portfolios that we're working with, but staff has done such an excellent job. And their executive team is second to none. I'm really, really happy with what we've been going on.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about, because you mentioned, obviously, council, we're talking about council, but there's a process right now about reviewing council composition. And again, I was thinking a lot about Ward 6. This is, and I don't know if you followed along or had seen the materials that were part of the town hall that Stephen O'Brien hosted Tuesday night, but the numbers he showed were a rapidly growing Ward 6 that is now the biggest ward in Guelph, not just in terms of size, but also in terms of the number of people. So I think when we're looking at how council might change in 2022, I think your ward will probably be the one most likely to undergo some alteration. And I'm wondering your thoughts. You know, are you thinking about you have to think about re-election at some point, but you know, in terms of, you know, what your area is going to look like in terms of the political coverage come 2022.
Yeah, for a long time, the council composition has been a real passion of mine. I mean, I believe we need to look at our governance models on a regular basis and review to make sure we're doing the right thing. And I was the one that proposed it initially back in my first term of council, that it got voted down, that no one on council wanted to fund it the way I did in order to have it done last term. So be it, but we're doing it this term, and that is great. So I've been a champion of this. I think we're doing it right. It's unfortunate that it's happened during the pandemic, but you know, so be it. There's a lot of things that are unfortunate during the pandemic, but we are doing it correctly and finally doing it. I've talked to numerous people who might ask me, it's like, oh, what should we do? What are you going to vote for? How do you want it set up? You know, should you be voting as conflict of interest? And a lot of this comes down to my opinion on this is not important at this point. This is a community led and, you know, through our consultants, but it's a community led event. And so that's why we need to get feedback from what the community thinks. And I may have my personal opinions, which honestly have migrated during the pandemic, what I thought was necessary and important back in January may not be as necessary and important now. And I can actually see how there could be some flexibility on that. But certainly Ward 6, anyone who was knocking on doors in Ward 6 can tell you we have geographically the biggest ward, certainly. And our population base has been growing by leaps and bounds. And that's without even considering Claire Maltby, I mean, which is quite a distance away, but that itself is adding 15 to 20,000 people probably. So Ward 6 clearly has to change, but we're not the only ward. I mean, you can't just redraw, because we draw one line in Ward 6. Well, the only ward that we're bump up against is 5. And so every 10,000 people you take out of our ward would automatically get added to theirs. So there has to be a redistribution of wards. There's some areas of the cities that aren't growing other than an occasional infill. Some of the more downtown and the older north downtown areas, they're not experienced population growth, where South End, East End, we are seeing much more development coming up. So we do need equitable number of counselors versus population base. It's never going to be equal because things are always in flux. And we're probably going to review this, have to review ward boundaries every 10 years, the same way that it kind of lines up with the census that they do in Canada to make sure that federal boundaries and provincial boundaries, they do theirs regularly. We need to do ours as well. And so minor adjustments are certainly fine, but taking a larger look and saying, how many wards should there be? How many counselors per wards, full-time or part-time? Those really big questions, it is so important for us to address it, because the answer might be, we have the perfect scenario right now. It's just redraw boundaries a little bit just to make things a little more equal. But in the end, our system is the best it can be. Maybe that's what people want, and maybe that is the right answer. But there's also maybe some room for improvement. And I think, given that the last time we reviewed this was so long ago, I think it's really important for us to undertake the work we're doing now. And I'm really glad we're doing it. I'm looking forward to the next phase as well, which comes into what we're going to do with compensation. Because obviously, you know, the second step comes based on the first step, because I do think there's some really interesting directions we can take some of that too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You play your cards close, my friend.
that's what's really important. I mean, people have accused me of that in the past as well. Well, they'll say, oh, well, how are you going to vote on this? I'm like, well, I don't know, because because I have to do my research. I have to get the staff report. The staff reports are so important because, mm-hmm. again, there are professional paid staff. We need to value their opinions. We don't have to follow everything they want to do, but we do have to get their opinions on stuff. And then what we have to do is listen to the community as well. And so I won't say that I don't have inclinations on just about any topic. Mm. I'll lean one way or the other before all this work's done. But then once you've done your research and read your staff reports and interacted with staff and interacted with the community, I might come up with a different answer than I was initially intending. So I'm very hesitant to usually commit to certain positions unless I have very strong feelings about something. And something like ward composition and council composition, no, I don't have really strong feelings on that. I have gut instincts, but we'll find out what the city wants.
Right. Well, I do want to get your feedback on what may be the most controversial issue you may be facing, and I imagine you probably know what that will be.
Are you going to say the library?
See, there's no moss on you. I mean, you're in an interesting position because you're representing Ward 6, which is the South End, and I know part of the counter arguments about building the main branches is having the hub and spoke method and having more branches in different parts of the city. But you are also someone who, in these deliberations on being fiscally prudent at this time, has said like everything's on the table. But I do want to address sort of the tenor of the debate right now, which is that this is an all or nothing proposition. Either there will be the $67 million library as planned, or there will be nothing. And what is your gut telling you about where this debate's going to go?
Well, I certainly think there is a binary aspect. Well, there'll be a $67 million building, and there'll not be a $67 million building. But there's a lot of shades of gray in there. And so if you step back to a year ago when this was brought up, we had a staff report that came to us, and we had to make a decision. And I was dead set against making a decision at the time because we didn't have information about what was happening with the government grants, which was vital, but also we didn't have the information about the new form of development charges in the community benefits, because these have huge implications, not just on the library, but also on the South End Community Center, which is a vital next big piece of infrastructure that we need to build as well. And so when the meeting came up last year, I wanted to defer things. I didn't want to press yes. I was like, let's wait. But the staff report was very clear. We need to approve something. Otherwise, we can't apply for a grant. So clearly, we needed to have something on the table. So in absence of all the information and making what I considered an ill-formed decision, in absence of that, I was willing to compromise and say, well, if we don't have any information, I'll approve 50 million. I'll put that forward as an amendment to the 67. I wasn't happy with any number, regardless of what it was, because I think we needed to wait for more information. But that wasn't a realistic thing for us to do. So when I put it forward in the 50 million, we ended up losing the vote 6-7. So it was very, very close. So at that point, it wasn't going to be 50. So the default was then 67. And the 67 passed much more easily. There were still some of us that wouldn't vote for a 67. But other people, which would often happen on council at any decision, if an amendment fails, so a lot of people will support the main motion. And so right from the beginning, I thought that we could not make a good decision on the library. And so go forward almost a year, and now we found out we get zero from the government on the granting program. And that is a huge key number. There was a counselor who said, it's possible we'll get nothing, but it is extremely unlikely that's going to happen. Well, it did happen. It wasn't extremely unlikely. And so there's a number of us that on council that say, hey, not only do we have new information and that we have to take a look at this again, but also, of course, pandemic, everything has changed regarding costing. Everything's on the table, as I've mentioned before. There's nothing that I consider untouchable regarding the city budget. So now that we have to reassess our information, I think we need to take another look. And is the $67 million library in its current form the right decision? Or are there changes that can be made? Can it be done differently? Can it be done in a way that is maybe more cost effective? Or maybe there's something else. I don't know. I'm on the steering committee for the Baker Street District, and so I'm maybe a little bit more in the know than some people. But of course, what it comes down to is some councillors believe that we need to take another look. And some of them have already made up their mind. Some counselors have made up their mind on what it needs to be. Other counselors have made up their mind on the other side. And quite frankly, a library could be probably 200 million, and they'd still press yes because they think it's the right decision because they're 100% behind the library. Mm. Well, I'm in the middle. We need a staff report on the new options, and we need to do our research on it. And I'm very big on evidence-based decisions. And while I made what I consider effectively an evidence-based decision last time, where I said, well, 50 million, I think it can be supported by the data, and I'd be willing to go with that. It's something that there's also a gut instinct on this, and we do have to listen to the population and see what the residents want. Now, as we all know, you can't just do what citizens want, because if you do that, you'd never have taxes. Right. If you say, do you want to raise your taxes this year? I would bet more than 50% of Guelph would say, no, don't raise our taxes. Well, that's just not realistic. We understand that the ramifications, and we have to guide the city in a slightly higher level than that. But the information is important. We need to talk to people and see what they want. And people have suggested, well, cut this program to increase the library budget, or take the library budget and do something else and decrease that and put the money elsewhere. So there's lots of different ways for us to look at it. And while we've made a commitment based on the vote a year ago for a $67 million library, and work has been done with that assumption, things have now changed. We do know our community benefit agreements. We know those numbers. So great. We have one piece of data from the government, but we got zero on the grant and COVID. And with those pieces of information, it would be irresponsible for us to not take another look come October. And maybe the result is going to be everything is the same, or maybe it's going to be slightly different or dramatically different. I don't know. It could be the binary, as you talked about. It's either going to be yes or no, and we're going to have nothing, or we're going to have something. But I think that there's room in between, and I don't know what those options are. We'll see what that's like come October, and then make the decisions then.
Appreciating that this may come up close to discussions in camera, the other piece of this too is that the library is a part of an entire redevelopment plan with a private developer. And is there a possibility that changing the library plans in any way have a negative effect on the whole development that could end up having it all fall apart?
It's certainly possible. We have contracts with external teams, with Windmill, who is kind of the project manager oversight, and they work with our architects, and they have sub people underneath them. So we do have contracts that we have, and there are exit and off ramps for the contracts at different times. We've committed to certain steps, and we've been moving through those steps. And if we have to make a change, yes, that could end up changing Baker Street, and it could be changing it in a way that doesn't affect the current relationships or the current status, but just changes some of the details of it. Or it can change in a dramatic way that if council decides to go in a certain direction and that doesn't align with what our current contracts allow, then maybe it's a very dramatic change to the contract, which could include not having a contract. So there's lots of things that can come from this, and we don't know what that is, which is why we need to step back from all the rhetoric about what we're going to do, because we don't know. What we need to do is we need to analyze it, research it, get the staff report, and make a thoughtful recommendation once we have more information. What we do know is we didn't get any grant money, and that has to weigh on every single counselor, has to realize, because we got zero, if anything we put into it above and beyond the bare minimum, that's directly on the taxpayer.
All right, fair enough. We'll have to leave it there.
And that was Adam A. Donaldson speaking to Ward 6 Councillor Mark McKinnon. Adam, I really enjoyed your article in the Today about the how we're probably going to have the library debate 21 years from now.
Yeah.
And the fact that you will be probably covering it, and I'll be sitting here, and we'll talk about the $1 billion library.
It's definitely looking that way. The mayor published an op-ed in the, I think, the Mercury Tribune, basically outlining his reasons why. I mean, there were perfectly good reasons. I mean, this is a whole other debate why the library is costing $67 million. And that's why I also asked Mark about, you know, the fact that it's a piece with an entire redevelopment program with a private developer. So who knows what's going to happen? It could very well be a 2041 problem.
God, just build us a library. Anyway, we're out of time. A topic for another day. Adam, if people want to get in touch with you or reach you and see what you do, where can they do that?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to GuelphPolitico.ca.
And I am Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and you can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRU 93.3 FM. This is Open Sources Guelph. Please join us next week. And it looks like we're being repeated Friday mornings at 7, so we are officially the Friday drive time show these days. So tune in then if you missed it, and you can also check out our archives for any show that we've ever done at CFRU.ca. And yeah, there's a ton of stuff there. So thanks for joining us once again, folks, and take care. We will hopefully, we won't see you, but hopefully you will hear us next week. Ah!